Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
I would like to introduce you to today's guest, Jessica Teich, who is the author of The Future Tense of Joy. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Jessica, as I was reading about you, it certainly sounds like you should not have a problem in the world. A Rhodes Scholar, degrees from Yale and Oxford, that automatically means that your life is amazing and fabulous, yes?
No, and that's why I wrote my book, because I felt like I was sort of caught up in these things that seemed externally to be of value, but inside I didn't really feel that I had a lot of importance or substance, and that was part of the journey I went on.
Well, you certainly gave me a resounding no, so I think you're pretty clear about that. Now, I'd like to start with... at the beginning of your story, I'd like to start with what you started with, which was your fear, in a lot of ways, of mostly everything. Afraid of germs, afraid of people, just there were so many restrictions that you had wrapped around your life. What was that about?
You know, I was afraid of everything, but I didn't quite realize it because, like a lot of people who suffer from PTSD, it seemed perfectly reasonable to me that the world was a very frightening place and that the people I loved were in, you know, imminent peril at every moment. And so when I would see my daughters cross the field on the way to swim practice or sort of balance on a stool in front of the kitchen sink, it seemed to me like disaster could strike. And that was, I learned later, a result of having been abused as a 16-year-old, sexually abused, and then the person who abused me, who was an older man, used to beat me when I wouldn't comply with his demands. And I never talked to anyone about it. I thought I was fine. And I think those credentials that you cited earlier seem like the, you know, substance of a highly functional life. But inside, I really wasn't fine. And I didn't know it until I found myself sort of doing really unreasonable things with my daughters and kind of compelling them to open the door with their elbows so they wouldn't touch the doorknob. Or, I mean, I didn't ask them to do that, but that was their response to my fear of germs on doorknobs. And that was just sort of one instance of the ways in which their lives were being transformed by, basically, by a violence that they didn't even suspect.
By your fears and by your experiences.
Yes.
You said PTSD. For those who don't know what post-traumatic stress disorder is, can you describe your understanding of it?
You know, in my case, I think it was married with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, which was something that I inherited from probably from my dad. So there was a genetic component. But what PTSD meant to me was that the experience of violence that I had survived as a 16-year-old, because I had never dealt with it in any therapeutic situation, it just kind of went underground. And, you know, it would sort of show itself when I would flinch, if someone would say something nice to me, or when I was brushing my teeth late at night, I would often see something in the dark. It was just all these ways that the fears that I had never dealt with and the feeling of unsafety kept seeping out of my life, like a toxic waste almost. And as a result, it started to really infiltrate the lives of all the people around me, the people that I loved most. And that was kind of what compelled me to start the journey that led to the writing of my book.
You know, the experience of fear, I would suggest, particularly a profound fear, is almost like an octopus. And it seems to me that it has several tentacles that, as you describe, I mean, they, your fear sort of touched so many people around you. They were unawares, and you were unaware that it was the fear that was touching them. But many people were impacted upon by the horrific things that you sustained as a young one.
Yes, and I think the fact that I seemed like the mom that other moms would want to pick their kids up from school or host them for a play date was part of the complexity of my situation, because I think on the surface, as you said in the beginning of our conversation, I seemed to be a person who had everything, more than even those academic credentials. I had this wonderful husband and these two healthy, lovely children and lots of friends and certainly enough food to eat and a cozy place to live. There would seem on the surface to be no reason that I couldn't relax and feel at home in my life. But it was this PTSD that was crowding everything. Those tentacles, as you say, that just reached into everything and basically were sort of creating a noose around the necks of my daughters. I felt they were being strangled by this fear that I couldn't even describe to them.
And around your neck as well.
Yeah, and I think like a lot of, you know how they say, sadly, you can put a frog in hot water and you just keep turning up the heat until it dies. I didn't realize the degree to which I couldn't breathe, that these tentacles were, you know, forming a noose for me as well.
Let's talk about the day that you put on your spy hat. It was a lovely little spy hat. And you began watching your 12-year-old daughter as she left school and went to ballet class, which had a lot of meaning for you on a lot of levels. What was that like? What was that about?
You know, I my 12-year-old was interested in ballet, as I had been. I was a passionate student of dance when I was growing up. And in fact, the person who abused me was a member of this dance company, an older man. I was delighted that my daughter became interested in ballet, but I think that started to trigger some of this fear. And she decided one day that she would get off at a different bus stop from the usual one and walk to ballet class through a sort of a public intersection that had multiple ways in and out. And, you know, it looked kind of a little bit precarious to me. And I decided that what I would do is not keep her from doing it. I knew that wouldn't be fair to her, but that I would hide in the bushes and watch her every single day as she descended from the bus, as she traipsed across the street, always giving a little pirouette in the middle, which troubled me more, and then, you know, sort of dance down the sidewalk to ballet class. And day after day, I would park down the street and climb into the same little niche in these bushes and pull my little deerstalker spy cap over my ears and watch as she got out of the bus. And one day she turned around and said, you know, Mommy, I can see you. I know you're there. I know you're watching. And by the way, it's a crosswalk. It's not a crack den. And I thought, oh, my God, how does she even know what a crack den is, my little 12-year-old? But, you know, she was wonderful in sort of setting boundaries the way kids sometimes can when the grown-ups who are meant to do that for them aren't able to do it. And she was sort of saying to me, I need a chance to be free and to grow up and to feel my life. And all this fear is just, you know, sort of suffocating me.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's somewhat amusing to think of a grown woman, you know, pulling her hat down over her ears and crouching in the bushes just to make sure that everything is okay and her daughter, you know, fares well. I mean, there's something kind of amusing about the picture of it. But then when you think about the motivation behind it, there's something so profoundly sad and almost overwhelming in the fear that must have been a part of your life. You loved your child. You clearly wanted her to live her life, but you were terrified for her life at the same time.
I was, because I didn't understand that what happened to me doesn't happen to everyone. And I thought that when she was poised right there at the brink of adolescence, that was sort of the moment when I got swallowed whole and I was taken away from my life. And when I sort of resumed my life as a college freshman at Yale, I wasn't the same person. And so when I saw my daughter sort of teetering on the brink of coming into her own as a young woman, as a thinking, sentient, passionate person, I thought, she's very vulnerable. And it's sort of, turned up the boil, if you will, under my fears. Suddenly the world sort of exploded like an oil rig. It seemed so much more dangerous to me than it ever had. And I think that even though it is silly to have been stalking her, especially since I'd been someone who had been stalked myself in a sense, it felt like it was absolutely necessary. That was my job as her parent. That was the only way that I could keep her safe.
It sounds like it almost felt like a compulsion. This was something you had to do.
I think that's actually right.
Tell us about what your life was like at 12.
You know, at 12, I was a very perfectionistic girl. I worked very hard in school, and I did well, and I was on the newspaper, and I was already a very serious dancer, so I went to dance class every day and then stayed for rehearsal. I was dancing with this local ballet company, and I think I was very much alone. I didn't have close friends and wasn't really able to talk to anyone in my family about, you know, all the thoughts that one has as a 12-year-old about the world, about growing up, about finding one's place and one's people, if you will. I just was such a social isolate. And a lot of that was, I think, because I was really buried in a book a lot of the time, which I think is a wonderful thing, but not to the exclusion of everything else. So I think I had already started to drift away from my family. And I think, like a lot of predators, the man who hurt me sensed that I was vulnerable. He knew that I sort of didn't have anyone. I didn't really belong to anyone. And so I could belong to him. And I think I felt at home in the isolation that was created by having this sort of double life, this shadow life with him. So in the sunlight world, I was this girl who worked hard and whose teachers, you know, approved of her and whose parents could boast about her to friends. But in my shadow life, I had this kind of secret relationship with this man, and I did everything I could to make sure that no one would find out.
You describe your mother as being poised and perpetually disapproving. So instantly I have a picture of mother. And then you described your dad as being a screamer and your siblings as being unkind to you as well as to each other. So it sounds like you were growing up in a household where it was relatively easy, if not safer, to sort of be isolated.
I think that's right. And the house I grew up in was designed by my mother. She had been one of the only women in the architecture school at Cornell in the early 50s. And she'd created this house for us in which, strangely, my bedroom was on one side of the house, and my brother slept in two separate bedrooms entirely on the other side of the house with my parents above them. So spatially, I was very isolated, too. And that, I think, sort of contributed to the ease with which I was sort of drawn into this relationship with this man, because he literally would come to my parents' house at night and knock on the window, and no one could hear. And I would let him in, and he would molest me in my childhood bed. And I remember many years later going back to that house. My parents were moving, and I needed to clean out my things. And I was there with my daughter, the one I stalked. She was a very small child at the time. I think she was two. And we went back into that bedroom to sleep in that bed, and I couldn't sleep in that bed with her because the memories of what had happened there were so vivid and so frightening to me. And, I really, after that, could basically never set foot in that bedroom again.
Oh, it's certainly understandable. In terms of the abuse, it sounds like, in addition to what certainly felt like at least emotional neglect as you were growing up in your home, there was also some physical abuse. You talk about a time when, as a baby, you wouldn't stop crying, and your mother hit you so hard that she sent your father to check on you to make sure that you were alive. That was a pretty hard hit.
Yeah, I don't think she did that again. I think she scared herself as much as she probably scared me. My dad was a much more physically imposing person. And he, you know, I think like a lot of dads of that generation, he did resort to, you know, physical means to discipline us. I think that his volatility and also my mother's remoteness were kind of a toxic combination. But I think that they were fairly common in that generation. I think my mother was one of those women, like many women, I think, at that time, who was very smart and educated and had lots of things she wanted to do in life and was kind of trapped, I think, at home in that marriage and with these three small children. So, you know, I try not to blame her because I think that probably her situation was a very challenging one.
Well, that's certainly understandable. Would you say that there was an average kind of day in your home as you were growing up? Were there routines or sort of rituals, if you will, that the family engaged in on a regular basis?
I think there were. I think one of the things that happened to me as I got drawn into this violent relationship was I sort of fell out of step with those rituals, such as they were. So I would come home from rehearsal very late compared to most kids my age, and I would have missed the family dinner. And I think those moments for connection, which probably exist in many families, I had sort of stepped away from them. And so in that sense, too, I think it just sort of enhanced my feeling of isolation. But I definitely think there was joy in that household. My father was a very charismatic man, very funny. I think he was particularly close to my brothers more than to me. But, you know, there was, like in any family, there was also levity. There was also occasional feelings of belonging to each other, of real connection. And I think that's part of what makes making a transition away from that so difficult, because every family has its own mythology. And I think as children, we want to buy into that. We want to believe and we want to belong and support our parents in their sense of who we are as a family. And then gradually I came to see that that mythos of my family was, you know, was really not helping me to find my own way into the world and to create my own family.
Well, it's certainly very true that children often want to at least appear to be the child that they believe their parents want them to be, which may in fact at times have nothing to do with who that child is.
I think it probably often has little to do with who that child is. And I think as children, we do try so hard to belong at school, at home, on the bus. You know, the rates of suicide among young girls have, you know, skyrocketed in the last few years. And one reason may be that because the ways of not belonging are, you know, have been multiplied. You can now see what everybody's doing after school that doesn't include you. Or, you know, you can have an awkward moment on the bus that goes viral. There are so many more ways to feel an outsider now. And, you know, I think maybe many, many children feel like they don't quite belong and that life is sort of a process of figuring out where you can be safe and where you can find a home. And it just took me a long time to do that.
The decision for you to go to ballet school was one that certainly was something that you agreed with, you appreciated, and for a time even enjoyed. We're going to take a break in a moment, but when we come back, I'd like to start with you just sort of describing the ballet classes before Joe came into your life and began to create crimes against you on a regular basis. Jessica, the ballet school, what was it like?
You know, the house itself and the studios were really ramshackle. They were kind of a house in a dilapidated Victorian mansion that was run down and overrun with cats. So in that sense, it wasn't very appealing. But what was happening inside the rehearsal room or the dance studio was so gloriously beautiful to me, was so transporting and consuming in a way. You know, there's dance, one of the amazing things about it is it's kind of a moving meditation. So you're involved, you know, you're thinking, but not really. You're sort of allowed to stop thinking, which is, you know, part of the wonder of it. And I think the music is so consuming. It's just has a very spiritual aspect. So as a small child, I was immediately drawn to that. The beauty of the world, the complexity of the relationships among the dancers, the way that bodies were entwined, and, you know, there was just a kind of sensuousness to it, and just a beauty and delicacy. And for me, it just became the center of my world. And it was the most important part of my day, going there, not just dancing myself, but sitting on the floor, even as a small girl, and watching the head ballet master, whose name was Vinny, watching him making dances. That, for me, became everything. That was where I finally felt like I was at home.
The introduction of Joe into your life, how did that happen?
Joe was one of the men who danced with the company, and he was unlike some of the other men. He was more of an athlete than he was a dancer. He was very handsome and very funny, and would always say sort of lewd things to the girls. All the girls were incredibly attracted to him, big and small. And one day I was in the studio just stretching with the other girls, and he came up behind me and suddenly lifted me up into the air. And I remember, because I was looking in the mirror, as dancers often do, suddenly I could only see my torso and my body beneath my torso. I couldn't see my head anymore. It was up above the mirror. And he put me down very slowly, sort of against his torso. I could kind of feel his body. I could feel him feeling me. And that was sort of the moment when he introduced himself into my world. And slowly, as the days and weeks followed, he just started looking for me more after class, talking to me more, teasing me more, touching me more. And then gradually, you know, I was kind of drawn into his world. Like all the grown-up dancers, he lived in this dilapidated Victorian house and in a little attic room. And as our relationship unfolded, I began to follow him up the stairs into this darkened room, and that's kind of where the actual abuse took place. But it was a very gradual process, and, you know, again, like a lot of predators, he was incredibly smart in almost an animal instinctive way. He knew that I was very solitary, and that whatever warmth he was showing me was going to entice me to want to be close to him.
You know, you referred to it as a relationship, but, you know, the word relationship really kind of suggests a mutuality. And you were a child, clearly, and he was an adult. So I'm curious about your use of the word relationship.
You know, I think that that's probably the central dilemma in these situations, is that you feel it is a relationship, even though, of course, it's not, and you feel the person knows you and cares about you and, you know, wants to be with you for all the right reasons, and, of course, none of that's true. But as a 16-year-old, and especially a sort of isolated, probably naive 16-year-old, I didn't see any of that, and I didn't see that the violence was progressing. I didn't see that the world was growing more perilous for me. I just saw the closeness to him and the fact that when I wouldn't do what he wanted me to, which was to have actual sexual intercourse with him, he would beat me. I thought I was deserving of that because I thought I was denying him something which I had seemed to promise by my openness to him. You know, so again, I think as a, I don't really like the word victim, but as someone who's vulnerable in a situation like that, you start to make up reasons why this person is behaving the way he is and blame yourself. And I think as a 16-year-old, I was pretty good at solving child-sized problems. This obviously wasn't a child-sized problem, but I didn't know as a 16-year-old that there was a way out because I couldn't think of one myself. And so I just assumed no one else could either. And I later learned in my research that many victims of domestic violence don't ask for help because they don't realize that someone else can help them. They're so sort of deeply enmeshed in the relationship that they don't see a way out, and they imagine that no one else could either.
Well, and certainly very, very often when it's a situation where a child is being harmed, the abuser lets the child know overtly or covertly that if he or she tells anyone that something bad is going to happen. And so, you know, children are so vulnerable to this kind of assault because abusers, for all of the harmful things they do, they're pretty clever, as you said, with identifying the child who's more vulnerable than others and then finding the child's weak spot, if you will, in terms of where he or she can sort of get in and really grab hold of that child and grab hold of that child's silence.
I think that's right. I mean, and I was a perfect candidate for that because I already lived in my head and lived inside of books. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was desperate to be seen by someone. So I probably, stood out as someone who could be easily consumed into that world and wouldn't tell anyone. He, of course, told me not to tell anyone. He said he would kill me if I told my parents. And I came to believe that he actually would kill me, even if he didn't mean to. I just thought that somewhere in all that chaos and all that violence, I would end up getting hurt in a way that could prove fatal. And I imagined how surprised people would be if in fact that happened, because no one would have known that I was in trouble. I would be that proverbial good girl who seemed on the surface to have everything. And I just imagined that no one would ever understand how I had gotten drawn in, because I would seem, to most people to be the last person who would be vulnerable in this way.
Did any of your classmates in dance or the instructors or any of the adults in your life, did they notice a change in your personality or your behavior?
One of the things that really mystifies me as I look back is how little people picked up on the signals, and so much so that Joe would come up to school at lunchtime and he would bang on the window of the lunchroom, and the lunchroom monitors would sort of gesture to me and let him take me out of school. This would never happen now, but he would drive up in his beat up little VW Bug, and I would get into the car with my lunch in a little sack with my mother's handwriting on it, that kind of wonderful handwriting that architects have. And he would take me across the street from the school to a meadow and molest me. And the fact that people sort of waved to me as I walked out the door, as if I was going off to a parade, now, of course, that seems, crazy to me.
It's extraordinary.
But I think it was a time when people really weren't aware of these things. And again, I think I seemed like I was pretty together, as much as, sort of a geeky 16-year-old girl can seem. And they thought I must know what I was doing. I mean, I can't imagine why no one stopped him and no one asked him to identify himself. And I never had to sign anything. My parents didn't have to give permission for me to go off campus. I think those things, many of them, I hope, are different now.
Well, they're supposed to be different. That's
right.
That's for sure. And, it is kind of extraordinary. But, it also speaks to people seeing what they expect to see. You described Joe. He was sort of athletic. He was a dancer, so he had a particular way of movement. And he was an adult, and that's what they saw, a nice guy. I assume they thought he was teaching you something, but they didn't even know that he was a dancer, did they?
I don't know who they thought he was, and he came up to school several times. It wasn't sort of just a one-time-only thing. But many, many years later, after publishing my book, in fact, some people I knew from high school sent me, I was newly on Facebook, and so newly reconnecting with people from all moments of my life, and a couple of guys said that they had once gone to the park where I was performing with the company and stuck around afterwards to kind of say hi to me, and Joe came out and threatened them very violently, and they said that they went back to the park afterwards to confront him, and he was already gone. But I cherish this little Facebook post because it's the only evidence I have that anybody in my life back then knew that something was wrong. And even if they weren't able to do more than that, just the fact that they knew and they tried to do something, whatever they could do as 16-year-old boys, that means more to me than I can say.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, the way that Joe behaved was completely territorial and just kind of, you know, almost jaw-dropping in the way that he took ownership of you and just seemed to flaunt what he perceived as his ownership. He treated you like a thing.
Right. That's true. And he had a dog whose name was a lot like mine. Her name was Jenny, and mine was, he called me Jessie. And I think that in some way he felt ownership over both of us, like we were both creatures of his. And I remember feeling very strongly that she was terrified of him, and I was too. And she was sort of my only, you know, companion, if you will, in this circumstance. Only many, many years later did I learn that he was, like most abusers or many abusers, he was also a serial predator. He had preyed on other girls in the dance company. I never knew that. I think the culture of silence at that time was such that no one would share that with anyone else. I do believe that the people who ran the ballet school knew that he was, you know, that he was a violent and predatory person. But again, I guess at that time, they didn't think it was their responsibility to step in. Now, I hope in most settings that wouldn't be the case. But of course, we know that one in four young women goes off to college and is, you know, subject to some kind of sexual assault. So in some ways, things have changed. And in many ways, sadly, they really haven't.
Well, and even that one in four number is based on the people who report. And we know that so many people still don't report. So that one in four number is likely much larger.
Right. And, you know, someone was telling me recently that on her college campus, they were teaching a seminar on how to avoid rape. And I was thinking, you know, what about just getting rid of rape on campus? What about really addressing the root causes of this violence? That's been much harder for college campuses to do, and it's absolutely crucial.
Yeah, you know, and that sort of suggests that we know that somebody's going to try to rape you, so here's how to get out of it, which
exactly.
is insane.
It's insane, and, you know, as you probably know, there are things now like nail polish that girls can paint on their fingernails so that they can dip their finger into a drink at a party on campus and see if it's been spiked with something. The idea that we're requiring young women to be vigilant in that way is just preposterous to me. Why the college campuses and particularly the frat houses don't feel they have a responsibility to keep people safe is, I think, an enormous problem, and I hope one that's slowly being addressed on campuses, certain campuses more than others.
Too slowly, but it is being addressed on some levels. That's true. The more violent Joe became, he would hit you. You would have bruises, yes?
Yes.
And what did you tell folks about the bruises? Did they ask you?
You know, nobody noticed except for my mom occasionally. And I would just say, oh, I bumped my head in rehearsal or I slipped. You know, I was, like a lot of dancers, I was a naturally very awkward person in my civilian life, if you will. So I was always bumping into things and tripping over hydrants and falling off curbs and stuff. So I think she didn't think any more about it. But I also think, you know, for me, for many years, the central question was, did my parents know, particularly my mom, did they know this was happening to me and yet not step in and stop it? And as I was writing my book, I came to realize that actually the central question was a different one, which was, what did they do once they knew? Once, as an adult, I told them what happened, my mom particularly, on several very important occasions. What did she do with that information? That sort of became the lens through which I began to look again at my relationship with her, because those were the moments that, in a way, were the most shocking and painful, when I did actually tell her, and when she responded in a way that was, you know, completely inconceivable to me. Those moments were differently painful.
How did she respond?
You know, the first time I told her, she said simply, you were so secretive, you must not have wanted us to know. And, you know, of course, now I find that shocking, because I was secretive because Joe made me keep that secret. He threatened me every time I dared mention telling anybody about it. You know, it wasn't that I didn't want them to know. It was that I didn't know how to tell them.
Right.
And I so hoped that someone would know. I so hoped that someone would figure it out, that someone would find us together in his bedroom, that one of the girls who'd been abused by him would sort of come up to me and say, look, is this happening, and is there something I can do? The second time I told my mother was, in a way, even more painful, because I was in my younger daughter's bedroom, and it suddenly sort of exploded out of me, this, you know now that this happened with Joe. Do you want to say something about it? Do you want to say how sorry you are that your only daughter has suffered, really, for 40 years with this secret and sense of isolation and shame? And my mother's response was, I could say I'm sorry, but it wouldn't mean anything, because I didn't know. And for me, that was kind of the defining moment, where I realized that now that she did know, it still didn't make a difference. She still didn't want to step in and help me or comfort me or, in any way facilitate my healing. And that was sort of the moment when the relationship started to break apart, I think.
Well, and it sounds like in that moment, her focus was on protecting herself more so than responding to what you were asking.
I think that's right. I think it's, now I have two daughters, it's hard to be a mom. And I realize there are moments where they come to me and tell me things, including about my own behavior, that are incredibly hard for me to hear. And it would be very easy to say, you know, no, I don't believe you, or I don't want to hear you, or I'm tired, or, you know, I'm busy making dinner. And I always said to myself that if I was lucky enough to become a parent, I would want to be a mother to whom my children could say anything. And I feel that that's one of the most important things one can do as a parent, is just allow one's kid to say, look, this is happening and it's terrifying to me, or I did this and I didn't mean to, or whatever it is. And I didn't have that. And I think that's one of the major reasons I got into so much trouble. There really wasn't anyone in my life I could go to and say, this is happening and I'm terrified and I don't know what to do.
There was no safe place, no safe person.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Jessica, we will continue. This is Pamela Brewer, folks. You're listening to Mind Talk. Jessica, you've done something very interesting in Future Tense of Joy. You tell your story. You tell the story of your story with your children, but you also tell the story of Lacey. Who is Lacey?
Lacey is the name I gave to a young woman who was a stranger to me, but she came to haunt me, and that relationship began in a very strange way. I was sleepless one night, and I wandered downstairs, and I picked up a 10-year-old magazine, and I sort of was slipping through it, and I came across the obituary of this young woman who was brilliant and radiant and beloved and funny and accomplished, and she had thrown herself from a building in Century City when she was 27 years old. And the obituary was written by two of her friends at Oxford. She was a Rhodes Scholar, as I was. And they talked about just the incomprehensibility of this action on her part. And I found, as I was thinking about her in the days that followed, that I was really puzzled and by that, too. I wanted to know why someone who seemed to have everything would make this desperate choice. And so it sort of sent me on a little journey. I began to kind of sleuth around and see if I could find out more about her. I hired a detective, believe it or not, who helped me track down her surviving siblings and her closest friend and her husband. One of the troubling things or dramatic things about her death was that she chose to die on the very day that her new husband was arriving from England to start their life together. And the fact that she was newly married and, according to the obituary, married to, you know, the man of her dreams, that was very puzzling to me, too, as was the fact that she chose to die on the 4th of July. So for whatever reason, she chose Independence Day as the day to set herself free. And all of those factors just sort of propelled me on this journey to find out more about her. And as I did, I gradually realized that I was learning something about myself that I hadn't been able to learn previously.
Had you ever tried to commit suicide?
No, I never did. But I, you know, I can remember when I was in New Haven at Yale, my mom came to see me and I said, you know, I sometimes think about throwing myself in front of a bus. And she said, do you know what it does to me when you say that? And I didn't want to kill myself. I think many people who commit or try to commit suicide don't. I just wanted to feel better. And I didn't know how else to express the sense of desperation that I felt. And one of the most powerful things I learned in my research on suicide is that a very high percentage of people who try to kill themselves but fail never try again. And it's thought that if someone can get through the acute period of crisis, the first 30 days, most of those people don't try and hurt themselves or kill themselves again. And I didn't know that, and I thought that was very interesting because I realized that I had this sense that people who committed suicide were, you know, unstoppable in some way. And it's true that many people do plan that act over many months, but in many more cases, it's a completely impulsive response. And in fact, reading a very interesting article in The New Yorker about people who throw themselves from the Golden Gate Bridge, I discovered that one person who survived that fall, most people don't, said that when he was falling, he realized that everything he thought couldn't be fixed in his life could be fixed except for one thing, which was that he had just let go of the railing.
Which is pretty profound.
It's pretty profound. And you know, it's interesting because many of these people, you know, there was a recent incident in New York where a bicyclist saw somebody on a bridge and talked him down, and complete strangers to each other. And apparently what compelled this person to step down was the bicyclist saying, I love you, we love you, and embracing this man. And I think that's very profound, too, because it's so simple and it's so clear that what this man in particular, and maybe many desperate people want, is, again, a sense of belonging, to feel bigger than, you know, they're part of something bigger than themselves.
If you could identify something in particular that you learned from your learning about Lacey, what might it be? You said she, by studying her, you learned a lot about you.
I learned about how important it is really to connect to other people. And again, it's interesting that the majority of suicides in this country are committed in less populated places. So even though there is a myth that you can be an incredibly lonely, desperate person in New York City, and I'm sure you can, the more densely populated the place you live, the less likely it is that you'll kill yourself. And so there's something about density or intimacy that keeps people safe, that sense of connection. And I realized that in my own life, I had been disconnected even before my experience with Joe, and that further isolated me from other people and sort of disqualified me. I felt disenfranchised from my own ability to be like other people. I always felt different, that something about that experience had really marked me and scarred me for life. And having these two wonderful children was the first moment when I thought, you know, there is something normal about me. If I can give birth to these perfect creatures in whatever way they are, then maybe I'm not as damaged as I thought. And that was sort of the way back for me, having my first daughter. And that was something Lacey never got to do. She never had the pleasures of a long marriage, of becoming a mother, of kind of settling into her life in middle age the way I think many women do. And that was part of the poignancy, I think, of what happened to her, is that she left her life at the moment when everybody thought she was happiest. But, you know, if anybody had been able to reach out to her and say, are you okay, just like the bicyclist did with the man on the bridge, you know, she might have had the chance to live a much, much fuller life.
It's interesting, too, as you've said, that she chose to take her life on July 4th, the day that her new husband was coming in, and in the same hotel and the same way that her mother had tried to kill herself, had succeeded in committing suicide.
Well, her mother killed herself after Lacey died. Her mother went to the hotel several years after Lacey died and tried to throw herself from the same balcony.
Okay.
And as it happened, that room was taken, and she ended up checking into the room next door and killing herself from that balcony. So there was a very strong linkage between them, and I think her mother just felt that she couldn't live without Lacey, even though she had two other children who were two of the people I interviewed for my book. But there was something about her relationship to Lacey that defined her. And she, once Lacey was out of the world, she didn't want to be in the world anymore without her.
And it takes me back to that octopus, if you will, with so many tentacles. So often when people attempt suicide, the sense is that either they're saving other people around them or that nobody will care, nobody will notice, no one will be affected one way or the other. And none of that is true. And again, there are many, many tentacles, if you will, that flow from that kind of act.
I think that's absolutely right. And one of the first things someone said to me as I began to do these interviews about her, it was her closest friend at Oxford, and he said, when I said, do you ever think about her? He said, I think about her all the time, because I think we should think about these things. We should keep these things alive. And so I felt one of the things I was doing in writing about her and braiding her story together with mine was keeping her alive and keeping both the beauty of her life, her accomplishments, her charm, but also the dark aspect of her life, the fact that she didn't feel she could disappoint anybody. She didn't want anybody to think she was less than she had seemed to be. And I think as a result of that isolation, she just never reached out to anyone and probably never realized how much love and support there was for her.
One of the things that we've touched on briefly is post-traumatic stress disorder and the ways in which it can affect different people. One of the ways that post-traumatic stress can impact on lives is with difficulty with relationships, difficulty with connecting, certainly difficulty with sexual intimacy. Lots of things seem to get smaller and smaller and all but disappear in the life of the person who is suffering from PTSD. Any of those things happen in your life?
I think all of those things. I'd have to check all of the above. And again, I think these things slip away gradually, and so you don't really see the loss of them until you realize that in every way, socially, sexually, spiritually, if you will, you are very isolated from other people. And again, I think if you're living a life where you seem to be doing just fine, it's especially hard to acknowledge or to have anybody else realize that you're drowning, not waving, to quote that wonderful poem from Stevie Smith. I mean, I think people thought I was waving and I was drowning and I didn't know how to ask for help, and I don't think anybody realized how much help I needed.
Tell us what your life is like today.
You know, my life today is more wonderful than I ever thought it would be. I feel very grateful to be in the family that I'm in and have been able to make a family with my husband and our daughters that's peaceful and full of joy and laughter and energy. And I love my friends, and I have sort of settled into my life in a way that I never thought would be possible for me. So in that sense, I just feel like, you know, this is a blessing, and I want to use it, and I want to really live inside it, if you will. I want to kind of live in the present tense. I really want to inhabit my life in a way that I never was able to. I was always sort of hovering above my world, disjointed, and, you know, I say in the book, it was sort of like I was looking through the smoked glass of an antique mirror. I could never reach the life, the vivid, tantalizing life on the other side. And now I feel like I'm there, for better and for worse. There's some days that don't go well. It's not, obviously, healing is not a linear process. I feel like, you know, the myth that we have in our culture that you can sort of leave your troubles behind is very debilitating, because I believe now, having gone through what I've gone through, that you need to integrate your pain into who you become. It makes you stronger. And I think if we all wait to, you know, get rid of this burden of unhappiness from the past, we'll just be waiting our whole lives. I think it's a very active, dynamic activity. It requires a lot of hard work to say, yes, I have suffered, I've been broken, I've been betrayed, and now I'm going to take what happened to me and use it to help somebody else.
Have you, as you've come out on the other side of these years of trauma and abuse, have you turned back to your dancing?
I have, actually. In the last couple of years, I've gone back, and it's been an amazingly healing thing, because I think among the things Joe took from me was the dance, the world of dance, a world that I loved so deeply as a child. And it's quite wonderful to go back and to reclaim that. And, you know, to see all the things that I loved in it are still there. The beauty of the music, the sense of dancing together. You know, again, it's that sense of belonging, of being part of something bigger. And the beauty of making a design across the floor with other dancers is just something that's, you know, I've never found in anything else.
What about writing? What was it like for you to write, research and write three stories, essentially?
You know, it was challenging. It took me a long, long time. And my younger daughter, who's now 15, among her many grievances is the fact that it took me longer to write the book than she had been alive. So the whole of her life was shadowed a bit by my going upstairs late at night to my little office and working on this book. But it's also incredibly liberating. And I, again, feel so grateful to have, the only thing I was ever good at was writing, and to be able to use that one skill as a way to write myself out of pain and into a much happier life, that's been incredibly gratifying for me. And you know, one of the nice things about writing a memoir is you begin to see patterns and things start to make sense in a way that they never did. And so even though it was difficult for me structurally to blend together my story, my older daughter's story, and Lacey's story, I began to see in the weave of narratives you know, these more general problems that I think many young women face in terms of feeling like they need to be perfect and also feeling like they need to be invisible in some way.
And that they need to be physically attractive to the opposite sex.
Absolutely. I once read an article in the New York Times that has stayed with me about a bunch of girls who I think were in a very good public high school in Massachusetts, and they were at the top of their class, editors of the newspaper, very involved in their churches or synagogues, athletes, you know, perfect scores on their college exams, and the only thing they could think about was whether the boys thought they were hot. That was their word. And I've just found that so sad, because the culture so strongly insists on girls and women being attractive and you know, so corsets them in this idea of what being attractive means. And I think one of the great blessings of getting older is that you free yourself a little bit from that, from those restrictions, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today. The Future Tense of Joy, a memoir by Jessica, pronounce your last name for me again.
Teich.
Okay. The Future Tense of Joy by Jessica Teich. Jessica, where can folks get more information about your writing? You've written other things as well.
Yes, I have two columns, actually, that I write. One is in Huffington Post, and one is for Psychology Today. And my website is www.byjessicateich.com.
All right. So now, when you're writing for Psychology Today, what kinds of things are you writing about?
You know, I'm writing about issues of loss or grief or getting over past trauma. I'm just sort of starting the column. I've only written two or three of them, so I'm kind of exploring the territory. And I'm actually very open to people's ideas. So if people want to contact me, my Twitter handle is @JessicaTeich. And I'd love to hear from people and find out what they think of my book or what they think I should be writing about next.
And can you spell your name so they get the right handle?
Thank you. So it's @JessicaTeich.
Okay, that's terrific. JessicaTeich. That's Jessica Teich. Jessica, thank you again so much for this beautiful book that you've written. You know, it's difficult to use the word beautiful when you're writing about such pain and such trauma, but it is indeed beautifully written. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. That's a free download. And folks, Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications are responsible for producing Mind Talk. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, an email to Pamela@mindtalk.org is the perfect thing to do. And let me remind you once again, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.